The man behind fusion food and a Miami teen takes on climate change. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Norman Van Aken has a lot of nicknames. One of them is the Walt Whitman of American cooking. He's considered the father of fusion cuisine, and he was an original member of the Mango Gang. He has a new book out and a new restaurant, and he joins us in studio today. But first, Delaney Reynolds had published 3 kids' books by the time she was in 8th grade. She did a TEDx talk. She did an MTV town hall with Al Gore about his recent film, The Inconvenient Sequel. We spoke to the Miami teen about convincing people, especially lawmakers, that they need to take sea level rise more seriously. All of that today on Sundial, here on WLRN. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Delaney Reynolds doesn't believe her youth is a hindrance. She's been working hard to raise awareness about sea level rise and climate change since before she was a teenager. By the time she was 13, she'd already published 3 children's books on Florida's ecology. This summer, she spoke to the United Nations. She was part of a town hall on MTV with Al Gore for an Inconvenient Sequel. And she worked with a couple of Miami governments to create more legislation that deals with the rising seas. Reynolds runs the Sink or Swim Project, an initiative that takes education about the issue into the classroom and also does political advocacy. I spoke to her just before she started classes as a freshman at the University of Miami. Tell me about the trip to the UN. What was your role there?
So I was asked to go to the United Nations and speak in front of the General Assembly on behalf of UNESCO, their World Heritage Marine Program, and the Everglades National Park. And while I was there with other children from all over the world from marine heritage sites, we talked about our Ocean Pledge, which was for the dignitaries and excellencies to sign to pledge that they would keep the ocean protected for future generations. And so we got to meet with several dignitaries and excellencies and talk to them about why we were so passionate about the ocean and protecting it. And we visited the Explorers Club, and it was an amazing experience. It was absolutely incredible. And it really showed me that children from all over the world are extremely passionate about our environment and that we really do care about solving the issue of climate change and all of the other environmental issues that we're facing.
When did you start caring about this issue?
My interest in climate change was actually very gradual. I like to say that my life has been surrounded by water because I've grown up splitting my time between here in the cosmopolitan city of Miami and a 1,000-acre island in the Florida Keys called No Name Key, in the middle of 2 wildlife refuges. And so I've always been enthralled with nature, and that's what inspired me to want to become a marine biologist and study marine topics. And so in between elementary and middle school, I actually wrote, illustrated, and published 3 children's books about ecology topics based on the island in the Florida Keys. And as I researched those topics, I learned more and more about climate change, how it was affecting the animals there, the island, the state of Florida, and the entire world. And so I decided that I wanted my 4th book to be about climate change, how it's affecting us currently, how it will affect us in the future, to explain the science in a way that anyone can understand it, because it's quite difficult for someone of my age to open an IPCC report and try to figure out very professional science. And it also tells real stories of people who are currently being impacted and how we can help solve the problem. And so in 10th grade, I took a class at school that was a leadership class called the Academy of Agents of Change, and it required all of the students to create a sustainable initiative. So I took the book project that I was working on with Sea Level Rise, and I integrated it into the class, and that's how I created the Sink or Swim project.
How often do you run into climate change deniers? And I'm wondering what those conversations are like.
So I've been very fortunate that I actually haven't met any climate deniers face to face, which is quite surprising, honestly, because I know there's a lot of them out there, which is, of course, unfortunate. And I see them on the internet. There's comments on videos that I post. There's comments on articles that are posted.
Do you respond to any of those comments?
I don't. I choose to take a more positive outlook. And my take on it is that we have to stay positive because we are going to have to solve this problem. It's already affecting us. children know that it's already affecting us.
But do you ever think about what those conversations might be like? At some point, you're probably going to have one.
Yes, of course. And so if I ever do encounter a denier, then I would face them with the science, because that's what I look at. And the truth is, the science is very compelling. If I were to show you a carbon dioxide graph, if I were to show you a temperature graph, if I were to show you a sea level rise graph, they all trend in the same manner, like a hockey stick. They all soar upwards. And that's because all of these events are related. And so if I were to encounter a climate denier, then that's what I would show them. And that's how I would explain the issue to them.
So let me play a little devil's advocate with you, since okay. I've met quite a few climate change deniers. Yeah, but you know what? Temperatures change naturally anyway. Maybe this is just a natural warming.
That could be the case. But if you look at the temperature data, scientists have been able to measure the temperature of our Earth since the 1880s. And 2014 was the warmest year on record in all of those measurements until 2015, which broke 2014's record. Until 2016, which broke 2015's record. And 2017 is already predicted to be warmer than 2016. So if that's the case, then that's 4 years in a row of the warmest year in all of those scientific measurements. We cannot deny that our planet is warming. If you can look at a temperature, then there really is no debate.
There's also, I mean, besides talking about what people can do, part of it is also doing it, though, right? I mean, what do you do to show people what it means to live that sustainable life?
I show them my story. So I have pictures of my house in the Florida Keys on No Name Key. It's completely solar powered. And it has a cistern, so I show them that it's very easy to live a sustainable lifestyle. And as a matter of fact, solar is very inexpensive. Our power bill from month to month is between $7 to $15. So not only is it very beneficial for the environment, but it lowers your electricity bill. And that's great for everyone. It's great for people's pocket bills.
We've been hearing my conversation with Delaney Reynolds, a Miami teen who runs the Sink or Swim Project. That's an advocacy group working to teach about climate change and help change local laws in dealing with the issue of sea level rise. Reynolds is in her first year of college at the University of Miami. Now, we're going to continue this conversation shortly. But first, remember, it's our membership campaign. And if you support programs like this, well, now is your chance to show that support by either making a call or going online. But I won't tell you about it. I'll let some other folks tell you about it. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, before the break, we were talking with Delaney Reynolds. She runs the Sink or Swim Project. That's an initiative that takes education about the issue of climate change and sea level rise to the classroom. It also does political advocacy. Now, she's working on her fourth book, and she's just a freshman at the University of Miami. Here's more of that conversation. So you've been very busy here in South Florida. A couple of things I wanted to point out. You actually did play a role in South Miami passing its ordinance recently that all new houses, new construction, had to go to solar power. We spoke with the mayor on WLRN, but take us back to, was it 2015 when all this started? How did that begin? And, you know, what role did you play in that?
So I had learned about the solar laws that they were implementing in California. They have three cities there, the biggest one being San Francisco, where they've implemented solar laws. And I thought that was an amazing idea because solar power can bring us into the future of sustainable energy. And what better place to do it than the Sunshine State of Florida? So I wrote a letter to about a dozen mayors here in South Florida asking them if they would be interested in writing a law that would require solar power to be implemented on all roofs. And Mayor Stoddard of South Miami was the first one to respond. And he responded by saying that he would be very interested in helping me.
Was he the only one who responded? How many responded?
There were probably about three or four who responded.
But he was the most...
He was the most involved. He was invested. He was ready to do this. And he said that he would help me as long as I helped him write it. I have no idea how to write a law, so I had to go over to his house a few times, and we spent hours sifting through the California laws and molding them to fit South Miami's codes. And when we finally finished it, we took it to the commission, and they went through 3 hearings and readings, and then they implemented it. And so now South Miami will require all new homes to implement the maximum amount of solar power possible, as well as any material renovations of homes. So it's very exciting.
The other thing, too, was your involvement in Miami-Dade County Commission, that you read their budget.
Yes.
And what was this? What year was this?
This was 2015.
2015.
Yes.
And you noticed that they didn't have a lot of money or any money put towards the issue of climate change and sea level rise. First, the fact that you read a county commission budget is impressive. But, okay, so you do this, and then what? You approach them because you want them to put more attention on this. And they listen to you?
Yes. The same day that I spoke to them, they allocated $300,000, and they also created Miami-Dade County's very first chief resiliency officer to help implement solutions for climate change. And since then, they've actually increased the budget to $1.2 million. And the budget for this year, the 2016-2017 fiscal year, is $1.7 million. So they've been increasing the budget little by little. And that's very encouraging, because even though it's not enough to solve the problem, it's at least a start. At least they're doing something with climate change.
What are the next 4 years for you going to be like? What do you expect, considering everything you've accomplished so far? What do you want out of your college experience?
I'm going to be a marine science and biology major in college, so I'm going to be studying something with marine science, and I definitely plan to continue my work with the Sink or Swim project all throughout college. The president of the University of Miami has actually come out and said that one of his top 6 priorities at the school is sea level rise. So I'm very excited to see what I can do with the Sink or Swim project and within the university to combine the two and work with them alongside them to help come up with solutions, especially because we have such an amazing atmospheric science and marine science program. So we have a bunch of scientists there that are working specifically on climate change, and they even have climate policy tracks that I've looked into. So I'm definitely interested in studying the climate side of science as well.
All right. Have you ever thought about politics? You just seem to know how to deal with politicians.
I'm asked this question very frequently, actually, and I've definitely thought about it.
Well, don't you think, because as a politician, as a scientist, yes, you can make more discoveries and find solutions, but, you know, the people who are going to make the policies and spend the money to fix problems are going to be those elected officials. I mean, is that attractive to you?
Yes, definitely. I think that implementing solutions is obviously one of the best ways to become involved. So I've definitely thought about becoming a politician, and I've definitely thought about looking at the policy side of science as well as the law track at the University of Miami. I just haven't decided how I'm going to fit that in with everything else I want to study, but it's definitely of interest to me.
And again, that's Delaney Reynolds. She's actually finishing up her first semester at the University of Miami. Again, she runs the Sink or Swim Project, an initiative that, again, takes education about sea level rise and climate change to the classrooms and does political advocacy work. She actually has just finished a draft of her 4th book. And you know what? She did tell me that her family does have a home on No Name Key that's near Big Pine Key. And as you heard in the interview, that's a home that they run on solar energy. There was some damage, though, during Hurricane Irma, but everyone is doing okay. We'll have more information about Delaney Reynolds and her project on our website, WLRN.org, so check it out. But remember, this is our membership campaign, and if you support programs like this and you want to hear more interviews with fascinating people like Delaney Reynolds, then support this program. Do it right now. Place a call or go online, and there are a couple of folks who are going to tell you how to do it. It's real easy. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, you're about to hear a very familiar voice on WLRN, especially if you care about food. I'll tell you first that he has been called everything from the father of fusion to the Walt Whitman of American cooking. And every couple of weeks here on WLRN, he brings you a word in food. Of course, it's Norman Van Aken, who is back in Miami, though he never left, with a new restaurant, bar, and cooking school, and a new book, Norman Van Aken, Florida Kitchen. It is great to finally have you on Sundial. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Happy holidays, everybody.
Happy holidays to you. Before we get into, because I want to talk about the book, about your new place, and a recipe that I found that I want you to tell me about, I wanted to go back, take us to before you were cooking professionally in South Florida. What was the scene like here?
Well, I pretty much escaped the grip of winter in Illinois, which is where I'm from, on a fateful day in late March of 1971, and hitchhiked halfway down and got a ride with some friends the rest of the way down to Key West. And so when I got to Key West in 1971, I felt madly in love with that tropical place and decided that would be the place I needed to live. But like many, I ran out of funds and had to go back to Illinois, took a job as a cook, and never thought it would be something I did for a living. I just thought, well,
it was a job.
It was better than working as a hot tar roofer, which I'd done before that. And I worked in a carnival for a little while and factory work and all this other stuff. And my mother, of course, was worried about, you know, what I'd eventually do. But the scene in South Florida that I experienced when I got there in the 70s, and it was, you know, it was Key West. It was a very bohemian place with all the attendant beauty that Key West is famous for without all the tourism that's now famous for.
And your first restaurant that you opened was in Key West, right? Was it Mira?
Mira was the first restaurant that I was a partner in. That's correct, Louis. I was the chef. Oh, I did have a teeny tiny part of Louis' backyard. I think I owned the walk-in cooler, maybe.
That's all right. We got to start somewhere. What was that like for you that with Mira? What was that experience like? I mean, starting a restaurant, even as a partner, that's terrifying.
It was terrifying, but it was all I could think about doing. I had a great partner, a gentleman named Pearl Perry, who was one of the owners of Louis' Backyard and even one of the owners of Sloppy Joe's, and a much different vibe there. And we set out to do something quite fancy and formal for Key West, because really that's where our hearts and our minds were. And we lived that adventure for about a year and then went broke. And I decided, well, maybe it's time to go up to a place where there's more of a population. So that was the last hurrah I had in Key West for a long, long time.
All right. We talk about fusion. We throw the word around a lot. It's very common. But I mean, really, you know, where did it come from? And was there anything even comparable to that? Were people even talking about that kind of thing when you really started doing it?
No, not at all. I didn't do it with any sort of consciousness that this would be something that would become part of the jargon of the language of food in the world. I wrote a paper, basically, for myself. I was trying to figure out what I was doing and where I was going, and I was very wowed by a book that fell into my hands. I bought it in a bookstore in Key West, and it was called On Culture and Cuisine, and written by a Frenchman named Ravel, Jean-Francois Ravel. It was way over my head in many ways. I mean, I'm not a person who studies these historic tomes, you know, by natural sort of flow. I'm a cook. But for some reason, this book came to me, and it was a history of cooking from the time of Taillevant, which is around 1400, to the time of the Nouvelle Cuisine food movement. And Ravel, his basic premise is there has been a long pendulum sweep in cuisine between very high-end aristocratic cuisine, the cuisine of the papacy, of the courts, and then there is the other side of cuisine, which is the more natural, feminine, matriarchal cuisine. And there has been this sort of argument that took place between the two as to which was more valued. And I remember writing in the margin of that book at one point, a fusion. And after I read the book and dissolved in me a little bit, I started to write a paper on what I wanted to do with food. And in that paper, I wrote that I didn't see why it needed to be one or the other, but instead, you know, the spinning coin between the two, between the aristocratic and the mama food. And that fusion was the primary definition for me, not of two different cultures that didn't know each other before. Like many definitions in the dictionary, there's definition one and definition two. Definition one for me was a way to harness the power of the really rustic, beautiful food that I fell in love with in Florida and in Key West originally, and wed that to the things I was learning by reading books, because I'd never have gone to school for cooking. And so I loved Bernays, or I loved the classic sauces or methodology of cooking, but I didn't want to forego the deep honest flavors. And so I said, I see the fires of fusion are coming, and this fusion will be between these two things.
What was the first experiment that you had with fusion? There's one thing now, you're doing this reading and you think of this idea, this concept, and you got to go in the kitchen. What was the first one? How did that turn out?
In many ways, it was just a surprise to people to see me even utilizing in a high-end restaurant, a white tablecloth restaurant like Mira was, black beans and plantains. I mean, I think, you know, there wasn't a single dish, but it was using like caramelized plantains with a veal chop that people were like, well, that's not normal. You know, how'd you think of that one? Where did that come from? And for me, there doesn't have to be a whole lot of rationalization. If something's delicious, it's delicious, and that's the most important thing. And so it was a lot of things that I was doing. I really felt like somewhere between Mira and the first place I cooked in South Florida, which was on Ocean Drive at the Betsy Ross Hotel, a place called Amano by Hand. Those were breakthrough times, breakthrough restaurants for me, because I began to move past me mimicking the cuisines of other places and creating a cuisine that emulated what I thought Florida should be.
I almost picture like a mad scientist in a kitchen, though. Mm-hmm. But I mean, is it one of those things where you're in there and you're just trying different things before you ever put it out? Or do you let other people decide for you?
No, I wouldn't serve anything that I wouldn't feed my mother. That's one of my mottos. You know, I wouldn't serve anything I wouldn't serve my mother on her birthday. And I always ask the cooks that I'm cooking with, the chefs I'm cooking with, would you serve this to your mother on her birthday? Or would you serve this to your mother on Mother's Day? So, no, it doesn't go that far. But, I can generally taste something in my mind before I eat it. I can look at it and pretty much know what it's going to be.
What's one that really didn't work that you remember best?
I remember following actually a recipe out of French methodology where we did some pig's trotters and we stuffed them with a force meat of veal and wild mushrooms. That was one that didn't sell at all. And then I did another one where I made a terrine with scallops and brains, and that didn't sell at all. So we ate well in the kitchen that night.
You have a new place.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Wynwood, not too far from here.
Mm-hmm.
And, right. I mean, what, it's just opened, really, what, in the last month?
Last month, yeah, yeah. Three is the name of it. It's spelled out, three. And it represents, the name comes from a few things. One is there's three endeavors here, Lewis. There is the restaurant, three. There is the roof deck lounge, the first in Wynwood, called Number Three Social. And then also, and I'm very, very excited about the opening of this soon, which is the cooking school in the kitchen with Norman Van Aken, which was the whole thing that brought me to the project, was the school.
Well, yeah, I mean, you've obviously worked with a lot of people, so you've probably been teaching people throughout, but is this the first time you've taken on this challenge of actually, you know, teaching people the craft?
In an ongoing way. I've done classes over the years for many times. I used to come up out of Key West, and there was a cooking school in South Miami that we loved called Ariana's Cook Shop, and she was a lovely lady, and she's still a part of the South Florida situation with food. Great lady. And we would come out and do that class. But those things were sort of individual situations. They weren't an ongoing. This is a whole roster of classes that will be for anyone. They're not for degree. And you don't have to sign up for a week or a semester or a month. You can sign up for a single class. You'll be able to go on our website and see what might be of interest to you and maybe your friends, and come individually or come with a group. We'll also do corporate events, and it's a place that you'll cook too. You won't just watch someone else cook.
All right. Well, you know what? We're going to talk about your new book out as well. There's a recipe I found in there that I want to ask you about. Of course, it's something I probably am not allowed to eat, according to my doctor, but who cares? Again, I'm talking to Norman Van Aken. We're talking about his new place, and his new book is called Norman Van Aken, Florida Kitchen. We're going to continue this conversation in just a moment, but if you enjoy conversations like this, remember, it is our membership campaign, and you could pledge your support to shows like this one. Do it right now. There's a phone number you can call. You can go to the website, but hey, I'll turn it over to the experts. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, joined in studio with Norman Van Aken. We've been talking about his new place. It's called Three in Wynwood. Also his new book, Norman Van Aken, Florida Kitchen. And I did have to mention, by the way, because you hear him on air all the time here on WLRN. I did say earlier, every 2 weeks, it's every week, you can hear him A Word on Food, which, by the way, he's been producing this forever. It airs Saturday mornings at 8:30, and it's you recorded your 239th episode. Wow.
There's a lot of food that I want to write about and eat.
You know what? We got a lot of catching up to do for our show. But real quickly, I wanted to ask you, before we get to the book, I wanted to ask you about this idea of the celebrity chef. I mean, I've been here in Miami now 3 years. Before that, I was in Vegas, where lots of celebrity chefs. But, I mean, what does that mean to you? Is it like extra work or is it fun?
I think it's a vastly inflated term.
Because you are a celebrity chef, that's what I'm saying. But what do you mean?
Well, I just think that, you know, like many terms, they lose their value because they're used so much that they don't mean anything. They don't have the same valuation. I mean, there were times where I think the number of celebrity chefs in the world were, and you could say we're 20, something like that. It's usually not, you know, meant in any negative way. It's just that, you know, when every time you do an event and there's 50 restaurants there and they're referring to everybody there that's celebrity chefs, then the word celebrity doesn't have the same sort of currency that it once did. And so everybody's got to make up their own mind what that really means. And it makes a struggle for new words, you know.
When did that term come out? Because, I mean, really, didn't we always just think of the chef as, you didn't see him because he or she was working really hard in the kitchen?
Well, there was definitely transformational time in France when Paul Bocuse, who's still alive and he's still sharing his love and passion for food, he became probably one of the most noteworthy celebrity chefs. And I would say that, you know, that was truly and is truly the situation with...
Somebody's calling you.
I hit these robot calls. I thought I'd turn that phone off. There are people that deserve that appellation. But, you know, it's all become so different, Louis, and since the advent of the Television Food Network and things like that, to where people are just... You know, there's food channel, there's all this stuff 24 hours a day. And like anything, you just got to, you know, you've got to like weed through and decide what truly is value, what really matters, where is greatness, and how can I find it?
All right, Norman Van Aken, Florida Kitchen, your latest endeavor, your latest book. The recipes in it, where, you know, are these the some of the newer ones for you, or is it a collection of some of your favorites?
No, this is definitely new stuff. This is one of the reasons that I write new books, is that it puts me in the learning position all over again. I felt in the previous book, writing My Key West Kitchen, which I co-authored with our son, Justin Van Aken, that was a fairly easy book to write because we'd both lived in Key West so many years, and we had a lot of recipes that we wanted to share and get out. My Florida Kitchen, which is the new book, published by University of Florida Press, they've been great. And they realized that I needed some time to do the research to properly showcase the totality of Florida. So this one goes from the Keys, still my birthplace as a culinarian, to the top, all the way up. There hasn't been a book written about the entirety of Florida in a long time. The last great book that I'm aware of is the Florida Cookbook, which was written by Caroline Stewart and Gene Volz, and that was about 30 years ago. Caroline's still alive, and she's a magnificent person. And I wanted to bring that same sort of authenticity to what I was doing. But in the book, and we've been trying to do this for a long time, we make recipes that home cooks can make. I mean, sometimes there are recipes that they'll have to be pretty dedicated home cooks, but this doesn't require a staff of sous chefs.
All right. Now, what I regret is that I'm running out of time. I've run out of time, and I wanted to ask. I know one of my favorites looking through the book is the Devil's Food Cake. Do you have a favorite, real quickly?
Well, that's a darn good one. Peanut brittle and peanut butter and I don't know. Just flip the book and here comes the no mas embargo Cuban sandwich.
All right. You know what? I'm going to bring you back. Can you stick around? We'll do a Facebook Live.
Sure.
Let's do a Facebook Live and talk more about the book.
Okay.
But again, Norman Van Aken, again, he's got a new place. It's called Three. It's in Wynwood. His new book is Norman Van Aken, Florida Kitchen. And of course, you can hear him on WLRN every week, every Saturday at 8:30 in the morning, A Word on Food. It's been a pleasure, Norman.
Mine.
Going to have you back soon.